A warm welcome to our Thursdays with David Foster Wallace series, where we every week read a section of the infamous Infinite Jest with the hope, of course, of finishing the book by the end of the year. Today's section is the foreword through the Year of Glad, which is between pages XII and 17 in the 20th anniversary Back Bay Books edition of the text published by Little Brown and Company. So to start off here and to introduce the series, I wanted to say two things. First, I think that this series is going to give us the structure and the ability to move together as a group, sort of as a reading club, if you will, to finish the book. I've tried to read this book many times. I've started over and over again, and I've gotten relatively far into the book without any avail of finishing it. And I think that the structure of this series, again, is going to give us just a lot of help and a lot of motivation and also motion in trying to read the book together. Also, there's a bit more pressure, right, to stay on top of the readings every week and to be able to comment on them or look at the blog or look at the vocabulary list every week. So that is why we are doing the series. I also want to say that I'm not sure any living person could give this book the reverence and the thought that it deserves. This book is a masterpiece. It's a watershed piece of literature that demands much more of its readers than normal books do. If you think about the normal 315-page novel, or even some of the novellas, or even some of the longer books that we've read, this doesn't compare. It's sort of in a different category, and it's sort of in the category, at least I would like to think, of James Joyce's Ulysses. Meaning that you should dog-ear markup and get a separate notebook for this project. It's a big one, it's going to be time-consuming, it might be frustrating at points, but it's going to be worth it because this is one of the books that I think everyone should read if they're interested in literature, and everyone should be able to glean things from. It's just sort of a microcosm in itself, and I can't play up enough just how beautiful this book is. I'm excited. I'm only 50 pages in as it is, but I'm excited to look at it and finish it with you guys. And I also want to say that maybe I'm not the best person to be doing this, but I'm going to try nonetheless. And so I hope that you can tell that I have a lot of reverence for this book. I care a lot about reading it and reviewing it on the show, and I'm going to do my best. That all being said, I want to say that there's help for you available if you have a struggle reading this book. There's a list of terminology that I put on our website, and that terminology goes by section. So I looked at words that I didn't know immediately or words that might trip you up, and I went through the Oxford English Dictionary, which is the foremost source on English words, and I just listed some definitions there. I listed the page number and the quote that the words appear in. So if you have any trouble with words and you don't have a dictionary source that will define them, they're on there on the website and as a link in the description. So starting with the foreword, this foreword is read by Tom Bissell. And I don't know a lot about Tom Bissell. I tried to look him up, and there's a bit of information in the back of him, but it seems like he does have enough credibility to be writing this. He approaches the introduction, or foreword rather, from a very interesting light. He goes from the concept of a novel aging, which is very appropriate, of course, for this 20th anniversary edition of the text that I'm reading from. And so he says that, and I thought his connections were actually rather astute, that this book by itself, the narrative itself, cannot age. It is humans who age the novel by virtue of having these apparatuses that age over time and that deteriorate. So it's not a novel itself that can really age, it's how we view a novel that ages. And so I thought that was just such a brainy way to put in the very first words of an introduction of this text, because I think it suits David Foster Wallace's style really well. And we go on to, in reading the foreword, we go on to realize that Tom Bissell knew David Foster Wallace, and he had a connection with him. So as the foreword goes on, it also gets more and more personal. He also talks about a list of things, which I won't get into for the sake of time, but in his narrowing focus, he talks about why he thinks the book has survived throughout time. And I think that's also an interesting thing to just think about in terms of what makes a book imminently readable throughout time. So we still read Dickens books, we still read Shakespeare, which was even earlier published than Dickens, and we might not read Christina Dalker, for just to give a random example, in 200 or 300 years. And there's no telling why that is, and I think it's a really interesting exercise to be able to go back and examine why a book might last for X amount of years. And in sort of the ending, the winding down of the foreword, Tom Bissell has this really wonderful quote that I'm going to read for you that sort of explains the vocabulary and why words are so important in Infinite Jest. And it is, "Whereas most religions deify only certain words, Wallace exalted all of them." So getting into the Year of Glad, this is the first chapter of the novel. I'm going to sort of summarize the novel and get into afterwards why it's so important and the things that I caught as a reader. And this is, again, not my first time going through the first chapter, but then the things that I caught as a reader and the things that I am sort of questioning or wondering about or musing about. So this is about a boy named Harold Incandenza. He's a tennis prodigy from Massachusetts, and he's interviewing for the U of A's tennis team. That's U Arizona. Not sure about what I think about the rebrand, but University of Arizona. He went to a prestigious tennis academy, and he has these spectacular grades with, they mention multiple pluses on the A's, and these essays that seem essentially like very specific college level essays that he has written supposedly for his application, though they start to question him, and these are the administrators and staff and doing the interview for the U of A. They start to question him about his test scores. So there are a few red flags here in the interview off the bat. There's this man named CT, who we find out later is his adoptive uncle. He does all the talking in the interview. He's the one to really play up Hal or Harold's skills and his genius. Then we see this instance in the text where Hal's genuine sort of smile at all of the administrators is perceived as a grimace and is perceived as, oh, Hal, is something wrong with you? So there's sort of a miscommunication in even the way that he's gesturing and using facial gestures in the novel. And then Hal tells the mold story. So from the mold story, we know that he has a mother and a brother in the NFL. He calls his mother the Moms, and his brother is named O. From this story, it's a very disturbing story. It's also the climax of the chapter. So the chapter sort of grumbles in, there's sort of a low hum, if you will, and then there's just huge climax, and it's a very interesting way to start out a book at the outset. So this mold story, he goes out into the backyard where the Moms and O are, and this is all from O's perspective later because he was too young to remember this, so he's quite young during this story, during the time period of this story, and he goes out into the backyard and he's holding a piece of mold, just a square of mold, and he's taken a bite out of it. And the mother, of course, she's not ecstatic about it. She's actually in hysterics. And we find out from this climax point of the story that the mold is probably the reason why he actually forgets to speak in the interview. So there's this really, again, it's sort of a disturbing moment where he is called upon to speak by the administrators to sort of explain his situation, to finally, after all of this hyping up by CT and all of his playing scores and everything, he's invited to speak and to tell his story a little bit, and he just makes animal noises. So my analysis of this passage is going to be rather short because I want to keep these episodes short, but what I noticed really on the first page is that there's this particularity in the first person narration. So we can tell this person is, again, very particular about the way that they structure their sentences and say things. And this is sort of a deviation from David Foster Wallace, but I also think that it's a really cool mirroring effect of Hal's ability to narrate. And again, this is first person from Hal. We learn a lot about him very early on that is going to be helpful to us later. So keep this first chapter in your back pocket as you start to read the book, because we're going to see a lot of faces as Hal, of Hal as the narrative continues. And this is important to remember. We can tell off the bat also, I think, not so much from the particularity, but from the fragmentary nature of the narrative, that he's uncomfortable and he's nervous and he's in a situation that he's not normally in. So again, this interview situation, and he's uncomfortable because he's sort of being put on display, and the anonymity of being just some person playing tennis is stripped away from him. And I think that as the narrative continues again, we'll kind of see how important anonymity and secrecy is to this character. So we also here get a hint into DFW's life. There is a resource that I put on our website. It's also linked in the description for you, just about David Foster Wallace. It's just a little, it's not a complete expose or an autobiography or anything like that, but it's just a little resource that you can read to get an idea of who we're working with here. DFW did commit suicide in 2008, and there's a long story that goes behind that. I think he's a brilliant writer. I've read some of his work before, and I just want to give you sort of a trigger warning that he did have difficulties throughout his life, and those difficulties do appear in the novel. There's also a notes and errata section in the back of the book. The back of the book also has an author's biography, and you can use that to parse out little bits of useful information that might come up again, especially in the first part of the novel. So I already talked about the fragmentary nature of the novel. So far, Hal sort of zooms in and out of this conversation. So one of the things that one of the administrators says early on that I just thought was a funny quote that I wanted to pull out for us, was a description of the heat in Arizona, and I'm from Arizona, so I thought that David Foster Wallace in describing Arizona heat this way was just sort of a beautiful way of describing it, especially because this is what everyone says. And so this is something that I thought displayed the talent of David Foster Wallace really well, in that he's super good at observing things and being able to explain them. So the quote is, "Try to get underway before the god-awful heat out there," though of course it's a dry heat. How we can tell from just the narrative itself and the first-person narration that he's very smart. He obviously wrote the essays that they are questioning that he wrote. He probably maybe got the grades that he got. His mother is an administrator at the school, so we're not sure about that part yet, but he's sort of a brilliant mind, and he has really cool ways of explaining things that are atypical for someone his age. And this is in a section where we don't know yet that he's forgotten how to speak, and yet he's speaking, and this is what he thinks he's saying. And this is on page 12. Quote, "But it transcends the mechanics. I'm not a machine. I feel and believe. I have opinions. Some of them are interesting. I could if you'd let me talk and talk. Let's talk about anything. I believe the influence of Kierkegaard on Camus is underestimated. I believe Dennis Gaber may well have been the Antichrist. I believe Hobbes is just Rousseau in a dark mirror. I believe with Hegel, the transcendence is absorption. I could interface you guys right under the table, I say. I'm not just a creatist, manufactured, conditioned, bred for a function." So this kid obviously has very strong opinions. He has a lot of them, and he's read a lot, and he's sort of brilliant. And again, this is juxtaposed with the fact that he is making animal noises when he thinks he's saying all of that. So that is what I'm going to leave you with, guys, this week. This was a rather long episode. Next week's is going to be quite short. And next week, we are going to go through pages 17 to 27.
If you enjoyed the discussion and would like to hear more from us, there is a show and a series for everyone, so I'd recommend checking out our website, relevanceofliterature.com, under the ongoing series tab for links to our entire back catalog of episodes. We also have a couple of open surveys that you can find through the links in the description, so if you have 3 minutes while you're waiting in line somewhere, we would very much appreciate your feedback on our show. Thank you so much for tuning in to this episode, and we'll see you next time.